from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Billy Crystal is that now very rare comedian who can talk to us about the tough stuff in life, the really hard and weird and uncomfortable stuff, and still somehow make it sweet. He's just turned 65, and he's talking about aging. That's hard and weird and uncomfortable. This hour On Point, the great Billy Crystal on aging, sex, death, and a big, long life in comedy. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What makes Billy Crystal, Billy Crystal? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's Billy Crystal reading before a live audience from his new memoir, Still Foolin' 'Em, Where I've Been, Where I'm Going, and Where the Hell Are My Keys? Billy Crystal.
As a kid, I was always drawn to the dark side of things. I knew at a young age that no one gets out of this alive. But it seemed that I had time. Back in 1961, when I was 13, I would think, in 1978, I'll be 30. Great! So far away. Then when I was 30, I thought, in 1998, I'll be 50. So far away. Now that I'm 65, I think, in the year 2038, I'll be mostly dead. Or as Miracle Max and A Princess Bride would say, slightly alive.
Of course, that Miracle Max was Billy Crystal. There he is reading from his new book, Still Foolin' 'Em, Where I've Been, Where I'm Going, and Where the Hell Are My Keys. Tony Award and 5-time Emmy Award-winning comedian, director, actor, and best-selling author, 9-time Academy Award host, star of City Slickers, When Harry Met Sally, Analyze This, and much, much more. Billy Crystal in New York. Welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
It is great to have you with us. You do a great read on this book. It is really... really fun to read. I mean, there's a whole lot in here. You've got really your whole life in here. But are you age obsessed now, Billy?
Well, yeah. As you come to the big ones,
yeah.
As you come to the big ones, my 40s, you get that little, oh, how did this happen so fast? And that turned into City Slickers. And then when I became a grandparent, I went, well, how did this happen so fast? And that became Parental Guidance that came out in December and did very well.
Yeah.
And now as I approach 65, I went, whoa, and it became this book. So I guess as each event of the big numbers roll in, it's like election night. We just got Ohio.
So here we are.
So the key states fall. And while everything else is falling, I thought I'd write about it.
What is it? What is it about the way you do it, Bill? I mean, you talk about everything in here. You got sex and death and the hard stuff and the difficult things with parents and family. You really don't shirk on hitting the truths that comedians are supposed to hit, and yet it comes across sweet somehow. How and we know plenty of comics with whom it comes across really hard. Where's the sweet piece come from?
I that's how I've always been that way, I think. I was, was raised really well. I was brought up with a great point of view about funny, about watching these master comics of the, mostly in the 50s on television, which was, Kovacs and Gleason and Carney and Phil Silvers and Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner and Sid Caesar. And there was a kind of comedy that I, really nurtured on was Cosby, Jonathan Winters, Jack Parr, Johnny. But it was always – that was a different time of comedy. You couldn't say things that everyone has said now over the last how many years. Lenny Bruce would be tame now compared to what you can see on Comedy Central almost every night. So I for me, that's just who I've always been.
Did you ever ask yourself as you went along, oh boy, look where this is going. I need to take a turn. I need to get darker, rougher, meaner, you name it.
No, I think that's a pitfall that a lot of performers can sort of fall into, no matter what division they're in, whether they write or they produce or they direct. Well, maybe I should do this, maybe I should do that. To me, you do what's truest to you, and you write what you know and what you feel, and then I don't think you can go wrong that way. But if you're trying to anticipate what an audience wants to see, it's never going to work out for you.
Do you hang out with comics, Billy? I mean, you've got Steve Martin and Robin Williams and Bette Midler all blurbing the book, and great. But do you hang out and do comics rib each other? How many F-bombs are you going to drop tonight, so-and-so? Or, oh, there's Sweet Billy. Do you rib each other on your styles?
Sometimes. I have a lot of very close dear friends, and when we do get together, we can kid each other a little bit, but we never really compare notes. I'm emailing with, you know, a bunch of, you know, some very highly regarded people. If you see something good, I always say, hey, that was great, that was funny. But you never like, you know, criticize or anything like that. But there's some good-natured ribbing that can go on. Robin and I have intensely funny phone sessions. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Okay. God, I can only imagine.
Usually, no, but I'm telling you, Tom. Yeah. Usually when somebody famous dies,
oh boy,
the phone rings.
The postmortem roast.
Oh my God. And it, usually it's a big ticket item. It's a, someone who's a fairly good target.
Yeah.
When Ronald Reagan passed away, watching the funeral, boom, the phone rings. I know who it is.
Oh. And it's talk about some bootleg tapes.
Bill, hey, it's Ronnie. You know, it's a lot hotter here in heaven. You know, I'm not sure it's hot there. Well, maybe that's why Nixon's in a jacuzzi, huh? And so, you know, it goes on and on. We have some classic confrontations that actually we should turn into an album. It would be hilarious.
Oh, my God. Billy Crystal channeling Robin Williams, channeling Ronald Reagan. We're on good territory there. You know, it wasn't that many years ago. I mean, you talk about how the curtain comes down, and it does. We had Nora Ephron on here talking about her book, I Hate My Neck, about aging. Mm-hmm. Of course, you played a big role in, you know, When Harry Met Sally, right in there, one of your big ones. Now she's gone. And you're big writing loss. About aging with this very clear sense of, look, you know, we know what comes next. Her neck was what she hated. What do you hate, Billy?
I just hate the fact that, you know, there's limits on things. When you're having a good life and you're with people that you adore and love and you're still thriving in your career and love what you're doing, as I do, you hate to think that someday, oh, okay, it's going to be no more of that. And I approach that in the book when I ask about what does death mean to me, and I just simply say no more. You know, that's the stuff that makes me – you know, a little squirrely at this point in my life, but I'm having such a good time now and on such a wonderful path of good things happening that I'm just, as I say, I'm just going to keep enjoying it right now because you can't look back, and I'm learning that you really can't look forward. I think you just, you know, I think you just have to stay
be here
in
now.
Right now. Yeah.
But you do a little looking back. It's a funny reference in here. I mean, here we are, Yom Kippur starting tonight. You talk about sleeplessness that has come, I guess, for you with age and how every night.
No, it started early, Tom.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Life started early.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm telling you, when I was born, my first 7 days, I was a Hall of Fame sleeper. Hall of Fame, 20 hours a day.
Yeah.
Then on the eighth day, somebody woke me up with bad breath and a beard and cut the tip of my penis off. And I've been up ever since.
Welcome to the circumcision, Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
Which makes you write every night like Yom Kippur. Regrets and atonement all night long, I guess. I mean, you may not want to think about regrets, but they come.
Yes, they do. You know, you can't help but flashing. What happened here? What? My mind is always – I'm a little factory that's always up. You know, the lights are always on and someone's always working. And that's what you think about. You know, I also think really good thoughts and really fun things.
Yeah.
But I'm a very restless kind of guy. And I don't get up and leave the room. I just stay there and try to at least rest. And maybe sleep will come, but it's just a reluctant visitor.
Right. So when that comes, and I know you're saying don't look back, but in sleep when you can't help it, which are the regrets? Are they professional? Are they personal? Both?
Sometimes. Sometimes depends what happened that day. Oh, why did I say that? That was stupid. I shouldn't have said that. Why did I say that to that guy? All right, he is the Pope, but why did I say that to him? But, you know, there's stuff like that and relationships with – no matter who they may be with, you know, personal or professional or even someone on the street that we had a bad moment, that, you know, whatever it may be, I let things get to me.
Do you get cut more slack as a comedian about the things you can say? Speaking of which, I wish I wouldn't have said that. Speaking of that, you know, like you get to say more things because, oh, he's a comic. He can say anything. Or he's a comic. He's supposed to be so clever. He shouldn't have said that.
Well, there's an assumption when they meet you that you're going to be hilarious. And that's not good.
Come on.
Yeah. Hey there. And that's not good. There's because, you know, they don't – people on the street, I guess we're talking about, and think that you're always on, that the person that they that they see on TV or listen to on the radio, whatever it may be, is going to be the same person they're going to bump into. But that person may have a migraine, may not be in a good mood, may not want to talk to him, may not want to pose for that picture on his iPhone that they hold at arm's length where you both look like it's awful. So there's an assumption that you have to be on for them. And when you're not, sometimes people can be a little squirrely.
But you grew up with people who were off and on. Uncle Burns, you write about. Yes. And we'll
genius.
Look at that. Genius. Okay. in the childhood of Billy Crystal. Billy Crystal is with us. Tremendous comedian for so many years. Beloved in so many quarters. Joins us from New York, and you can join us this hour. What makes Billy Crystal, Billy Crystal? Among all the comedians we've got, how do you see Billy, his angle, his kind of humor, and where do you like him best? In the clubs, on stage, When Harry Met Sally, in Analyze This, City Slickers, up there hosting the Oscars, behind us right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Billy Crystal. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
It's the Oscars, so kick off his shoes.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with the great Billy Crystal at 65 about his life and life in comedy. He's out with a big new memoir, Still Fooling Him, Where I've Been, Where I'm Going, and Where the Hell Are My Keys. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Billy Crystal's with us from New York. One of the places he was, well, When Harry Met Sally, 1989, with this famous, famous Meg Crystal line. Here we go.
Oh, God. Oh.
I'll have what she's having.
Meg Ryan showing Billy Crystal's character that men can't tell when a woman is faking an orgasm. He writes about that scene in the new book. That the voice you just heard there was the mother of the director of the film, Rob Reiner, his Billy Crystal in Still Fooling Him.
Rob's wonderful mother, Estelle, was sitting at a nearby table. She would be the I'll have what she's having lady. So we start to rehearse, and Meg seemed tentative. First orgasm, so-so. Next one, like we'd been married for 10 years. Perhaps she was nervous about sharing her orgasm with so many strangers. Rob now gets a little bit impatient, asks her to step aside for a moment so he could show her what he wants. Now I'm sitting across from this large, sweaty, bearded man. It looked like I was on a date with Sebastian Cabot. He then had an orgasm that King Kong would have envied. He's screaming, yes, 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 banging the table so hard pickles are flying. Coleslaw was in the air. And then when he was done, the background artists applaud, and Rob took me aside and said, oh, I made a mistake. I made a mistake. I shouldn't have done that. No, Meg will be okay. I don't think you embarrassed her, I said. That's not what I meant. I just had an orgasm in front of my mother. Now, once we started shooting, Meg was spectacular. All day, with the camera either on her or on me, she had sensational orgasms. My reactions to her became more fun to do as she came up with new little moans and groans. Months later, when Rob had finished his first cut of the picture, we had a test screening in Pasadena, California. The movie was playing really well. And then came the orgasm scene. Well, the laughs were enormous. And when Estelle said her line, the place exploded. I was sitting in the back with Rob, and we just grabbed each other's arms because we knew we had something special.
Billy, do people ever stop asking you about that scene? It must be number one on the hey, what about?
It's a big one, yeah, and it's a great scene. And over time, as more and more people have grown up, it's become another generation's romantic comedy. So yes, that's from movies. People will come up to me and go, you're good, from Analyze This.
Right.
And a lot of people still hold up a finger and say, what's the one thing from City Slickers? So,
yeah.
Listen, if you have one of those in your career,
yeah,
that's a fantastic thing. I've got a few of those, and that's really wonderful.
We've got the inevitable question here on Facebook from Joe. Said, which character was it most fun to play? Miracle Max, Harry Burns, Morty the Mime? I mean, how do you look at the different characters? Were there some that you just float into more naturally, some that stick with you longer? Are they all in the closet and fine?
I like all of them. Miracle Max was particularly fun because I only worked 3 days on The Princess Bride.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was there 3 days, and You know, they never saw my real face. I got to the studio at 2 o'clock in the morning. I was ready to go by 7. That's a long, long day already of putting the stuff on my face, which I asked my makeup man, Peter Montagna, to make me look like a combination of my grandmother and Casey Stengel, which Miracle Max did. And if you're doing a scene with a slightly dead guy, another woman who looks like you, Carol Kane, a giant, Andre, yeah, and Mandy Patinkin,
yeah,
and Carrie Elway on the table there. If you can't have a good time in that scene, and a director, again, Rob, who would just trust me. He said, go, we got what we need. Just have fun. Just say stuff. And that's where the mutton and lettuce and tomato sandwich came out of. That was all improvised. And then we just kept going and going and just playing around. And so I was so trusted by him, as I was in When Harry Met Sally. He's the best director an actor can work with.
Nat wants
so
to
I would say Miracle Max was a lot of fun. Well, I have fun with all of them.
Yeah.
My favorite character that I played actually was Buddy Young Jr. in Mr. Saturday Night, which was not a big hit but was a fantastic character to play because he was so different than me, a very caustic, bitter, angry, older comic who really feels the pressure of time in not a good way and really feels that he blew it. That was a particular joy to play him.
Did it let you get it all out, Billy?
For him, yeah. But, you know, as I looked in the mirror every morning, at 53 days, I directed the movie too, at 53 days of old age makeup, plus directing the movie. And I'd look at myself with this, once they started applying the makeup, and I always then said to myself, well, this is a rehearsal. I'm getting ready.
Yeah. Take us back to Uncle Burns and the sort of early influences. Nat asks, you know, where'd you learn your delivery, your timing, the weight? And your book reads as though it was sort of right there in childhood. Not just Uncle Burns, but you've got another uncle who's big in music production, Rock Around the Clock, all the rest.
Yeah, my Uncle Milt Gabler was a real pioneer in not only jazz recording. He created our family business, which was a jazz label called the Commodore Jazz Label. Classics and Swing. We had a little record store on 42nd Street between Lexington and 3rd in New York called the Commodore Music Shop. My dad was the manager of the store. My grandfather owned the store, and Milt was the star of the store. He created the label, which was at the time, Tom, the first independently owned jazz label of its kind. And so the family was always in the music business, in the jazz business. And Milt would later go to Decca Records, where he would produce in his 33 years there, I believe 31 albums and records that sold over a million copies.
Sammy Davis Jr., Bing Crosby, Nat King Cole, bunch of bigs.
Amazing. And Rock Around the Clock, he wrote Fine and Mellow with Billie Holiday, produced Strange Fruit, her most important song. So he was a giant. So I was always around the clubs. My dad produced jazz concerts all around New York City, and so I would always be around. But the delivery really became, you know, really watching all of these great comedians on television, but then with my brothers and I performing in the living room in front of the relatives. But Uncle Burns, he was my dad's younger brother, was a gigantic influence on all of us. And there's a big chapter about him. He's actually a character throughout the book.
Yeah.
His spirit, Tom, he was an amazing man, 6'4", 240 pounds, drop dead handsome. And as he got older, he grew this. He actually is in When Harry Met Sally. He plays Santa Claus.
Okay.
And that's who he was to me. He was this big Santa Claus and this beautiful white beard and flowing white hair. But his sense of humor was astounding. And he was a combat artist at D-Day.
What does that, mean? He was drawing pictures from the boat?
Yes, and he came ashore. He would come ashore with a pencil and a pad, and draw the embankments and draw where the fortifications were, because you couldn't develop film fast enough. There was no video.
Yeah.
There was, you know, no one came ashore at the Omaha Beach with an iPhone.
Yeah,
you know, so he sketched it, and then we go. He'd rip it out of pad, and they'd give it to whoever was, you know, in charge of that that platoon and so on and so forth, and. But he had an amazing ability to draw and sketch. It's odd, you know. I'm sitting here in the studio, And before we started, I drew a character that he taught me how to draw, not knowing that we were even going to talk about him. He's always with me. He passed away in 2008, September 26th.
But the doodle goes on.
Yeah, and his artwork is stunning. He made these beautiful war bond posters and calendars and stuff for all the army magazines, and at Eisenhower's request, drew him. And he was just this – he was like Zero Mostel.
Mm, wow.
Who he actually represented as an art dealer when Burns became an art dealer. And they were very – so for listeners, if you remember the amazing Zero Mostel,
sure.
This huge body, face could do anything.
Yeah.
That was Burns.
So we'll see you. We have seen you, no doubt, channeling a little bit of that when we see you. Mm-hmm.
My daughter actually, and it's very apropos. The anniversary of 9/11 was this past week, mm-hmm. And Burns lived right across the street from the towers, and my younger daughter Lindsay was a student at NYU. And I kept encouraging her to go see him, you know, hang out with him at his art gallery. He's, you know, and, you know, college kids didn't spend as much time with him. I understood. But when the towers came down and he was evacuated, she realized, oh, my God, if he had died that day, I would never have known who this, you know, this man is. So she started interviewing him on camera. And over 2 years, it became a fascinating documentary called My Uncle Burns, which then aired on HBO and won a bunch of film festivals. So if anyone could track that down, they could actually get to see this, to me, this miracle man.
You want to know what makes Billy Crystal? Billy Crystal, there's a big piece of it. His new memoir is still fooling him. You went off to college and you stayed in jazz for a while. I mean, there's pictures of you very, very young here, not 65, at the campus radio station at WUMI. Was it West Virginia?
No, WMUL.
MUL,
the voice of Marshall
MUL,
University.
Yeah, yeah, MUL.
You're listening to Billy Crystal here in WMUL, the voice of Marshall University, and the show is called Just Jazz.
Did you think you were going to stay on that line? You'd be the big producer?
No, you know, I was
playing. You were a clarinetist too?
I play clarinet. I still play a little bit. Yeah. Not as good as Woody, but I'm okay.
Yeah.
And taught by some great jazz musicians, the great Pee Wee Russell, who was one of the great jazz clarinetists and soloists of all time, was a frail man and didn't use much breath to get these amazing solos out of his clarinet. And at times I would be backstage at concerts that I would do, I'd always bring my horn, and Pee Wee would say to me when he would be there, "Billy, tease it out. Just tease it out. Don't blow so hard. Mm. Just tease it out. The horn will know what you want to say."
Yeah.
And, So Marshall, my 1 year there, I was really there to be the second baseman for the Marshall University baseball team, I was hoping. Mm. And I was down. My dad had died, and it was my first time away from home. I was a young 17 in so many ways, an old man in other ways.
Yeah.
And found my way to the campus radio station, and with a wonderful speech teacher named Dorothy Johnson, she encouraged me to you know, try a show. And she said, "What do you know about? What do you like?" And I said, "Well, I know a little bit about jazz." I mean, I really was not a rock and roll guy, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I can not name rock and roll classics, but I'll tell you what's the B-side of a certain album and what the solo was like on a jazz record. So I went into the library at the campus station. And they said, "Well, you know, it was a 5-watt station." Mm. And I looked at what they in the files and in the stacks of now these were records.
Yes, sure.
If any listeners remember
those
records,
right. Big hunks of stuff.
Yeah, and the jazz was, you know, section was Roy Clark. So
yeah, please,
I don't know why, but I wrote a letter to the great John Hammond at Columbia, who was, you know, one of the great record producers and headed the studio and the record company. And my dad had always spoken so highly of what a great man John Hammond was. And I just took a chance. I wrote him a letter, told him I was Jack Crystal's son. I'm a disc jockey on a campus radio station.
Yeah.
We have no jazz records and so on. Now, that's when we had letters.
Yes.
Also on
it
top
would be
of records.
Ink on paper. Yes.
Yes. Oh, man. And within 2 weeks, I got 50 classic jazz albums from him and the entire catalog that we could buy records for $1 a piece with a beautiful letter, which I framed telling me how much he respected my dad and how fond he was of him and my dad's legacy in the music business. My dad was one of the first concert promoters to integrate bands, to play African-American players with white players. And that wasn't happening a lot. And they loved him. They just adored him. And he never made any money at it. Yeah. He did it because he loved the music.
You hear timing in Billy Crystal's comedy. Think a little bit about jazz right there. His new memoir is Still Fooling Him. Billy, you write in the book about how your very first day there in West Virginia, you walked into a little, I don't know, some kind of corner store restaurant, and boom, you had anti-Semitism right in your face. Yom Kippur is tonight.
Yeah.
What about that moment? And what about the Jewish culture as a backdrop to your humor?
That first day, you know, I was leaving home. We had been through a big hit, you know. And my brothers were all away at college, so just me and my mom for a couple
of years. Of your father's death.
So we had taken one broadside. Mm-hmm. And I'd never been to sleepaway camp. I very rarely slept over at a friend's house. You know, it was just, that's how it was. And now I'm in West Virginia, in Huntington, West Virginia, which is a lovely town, but I'm a lonely 17-year-old kid, and it was a hot, steamy night. And
out of New York.
Yep, and walked into town, and there was a place called the White Pantry, and I never thought anything about it. I'm wearing my mezuzah, Jewish star, around my neck, like I always did, you know. Mm-hmm. And I ordered something to eat, and he refused to serve me. And I said, "Are you closed?" Because the place was packed, and he pointed to a sign, "We reserve the right not to serve you." And I went, "What?" And he just sort of made a note, you know, "Look, it's the thing around your neck, buddy." And I got up and left. And that's the, you know, I was raised in a town that was, you know, mostly, I sound like Miracle Max, they were mostly Jews and slightly Gentile. No, it was a real mix. But when you're brought up in a Jewish heritage, I never thought about anything like that. And living in a house that had African-American jazz musicians, you know, smoking bitter herbs at Passover, thought about anything like that? Yeah. So that was the first time. And I reluctantly took it off and kept it in a box the rest of the year.
And when you left the university and went back, I don't know, to earlier life, did it go back on?
I have it. I still have it. I sort of keep it there as a reminder of not to feel that way about anybody.
Billy Crystal is with us, the great comic Billy Crystal. He's out with a new memoir, Still Fooling Him, Where I've Been, Where I'm Going, and Where the Hell Are My Keys. We'll come to your calls after a little break here. How does Billy Crystal get us going, roaring, even on tough stuff, and still have that sweetness about him? What's your question for Billy Crystal? As You Look Marvelous from Saturday Night Live, he had quite the time back in that venue, and so many more. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Billy Crystal. This is On Point.
Look at me dancing around in there. I look marvelous. Absolutely marvelous. You know, darling, I love dancing. Dancing to me is like standing still, only faster. You know what I'm saying to you? My dear, do you understand the term full-grown midget? Must be me. There are 8 million stories of the naked city, darling. Let's be two of them. I'm kidding you. I'm a kidder.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the great Billy Crystal at 65 about his life and life in comedy. He writes about it in his new memoir, Still Fooling Him, Where I've Been, Where I'm Going, and Where the Hell Are My Keys. Billy Crystal joins us in New York. Here's a little bit of the book. He talks about having, you know, been pretty much a social liberal all his life, but getting tougher, not always so liberal. Here's Billy Crystal from Still Fooling Him.
Lately, it's getting harder for me to feel optimistic about the world. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, this is why. Good evening, I'm Wolf Blitzer with bad news. I'm Chris Wallace with even more bad news. I'm Rachel Maddow. Don't even ask. I'm Brian Williams. They're wrong. It's worse. It's become a race between what's falling apart faster, the world or my body. All the problems in the world have gotten me so angry that now I, Billy Crystal, a lifelong liberal, am becoming a tad conservative,
Not on social issues. I'm still the pro-gay marriage, pro-civil rights, anti-war, feed the hungry, and house the homeless. It's okay to have red wine with fish, liberal-thinking guy I have always been. But in other areas, I'm drifting. It's like I'm my grandfather driving his car in the left lane of the freeway at 20 miles an hour, sitting as low as possible so people behind him can't tell if anyone's actually behind the wheel. And slowly, the car is drifting to the right. And when did this drift to the right start? It started years ago when I was watching the news and saw that vile Richard Speck, who was in prison for life for killing 8 student nurses, had been injecting himself with female hormones and was growing breasts and having wild sex with his inmate boyfriend. Some punishment. That's not prison. That's spring break. Why is he still alive? I found myself asking. I knew I was really driving in the right lane the day I saw Jared Lee Loeffner pleading guilty with an idiot smile on his face to killing 6 people, including that beautiful little girl who had her whole life ahead of her, and critically wounding Gabby Giffords. 6 people are dead. A great woman is permanently damaged, and he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison? We're paying to keep that sick smile on his face? Up until then, I was against the electric chair. Now I'm for the electric stadium.
Billy Crystal, reading from Still Fooling Him. Drift to the right, indeed. How far out there? I mean, not just an electric stadium, but you say you want vendors in there and have the national anthem.
Get your last meal here. Last meal here. Come on, last meal. You know, first of all, Tom, we have to remember this is a humor book.
Well, yeah. But you're talking about a drift. It's a real drift.
Yeah, those things do bother me, I have to admit.
It sounds like Mr. Saturday Night right there.
Well, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of... There's a lot of people who feel the same way after a while, and, you know, you'd like to, you know, as far as those things, those heavy things about, you know, capital punishment, all that, it's a big issue with a lot of people, but there's sometimes you look at it and, you know, you just don't get it. I just sometimes just don't get it. I understand that there are a lot of innocent people who, you know, meet their demise, and that's a shame. But on the other hand, when there are horrible, you know, obviously guilty, caught with their hand on the gun people, I don't understand sometimes why the costs of these things and the are inflicted on you know, on us. And so that does bother me.
Sweet Billy Crystal, ready to build not the electric chair, the electric stadium right there. Let's dive in with our listeners. Margaret in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. You're on the air with Billy Crystal, Margaret.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is awesome. I can't tell you how much I enjoy Billy Crystal. First time I saw him on an improv show many years ago with Robin Williams and 2 other comedians who remain nameless to this day. And I have enjoyed every single thing he's ever done. It's just an honor to get to listen to this, and I can't wait to get my hands on the book.
What about him, Margaret? What is it about Billy Crystal that, I don't know, gives you that pleasure?
He's down, honest, funny. I don't see a pretense. I don't see a put on. I don't see this forcing with foul language and all of that. He's just down to earth funny.
You better believe it's there right from the opening page in this one, the talk about when the bathrobe falls open with your wife, and there's a lot of commentary on the results of aging. Boom, there we go. Margaret, I appreciate your call so much. Thank you for that. Dorothy in Lowell, Massachusetts. Dorothy, you're on with Billy Crystal.
Hi, Billy. This is Dot. I'm calling because out of all the programs and things that you've done, my favorite was Soap. I loved you in that program, Soap. It was a sitcom that used to come on, and I just wanted to know, why did they discontinue it, and how come we don't have recaps on it?
Dorothy, thank you. So, Billy, would you just describe that? That's way back there, what, 77, 81?
1970s, I can't believe that it's 36 years ago. Yeah. Soap was a groundbreaking show at the time. It was a weekly soap opera on ABC in which I played a young man named Jody Dallas, who was a gay character, who was a director of commercials, mm-hmm. Whose boyfriend was an NFL quarterback, and I was part of an insane family known as the Campbells, and there were 2 families. There was the Tates and the Campbells. Now, the show came on with outrage, and people really hadn't even seen the show because there was a couple of situations in the show that were not usual fare for network situation comedies. First of all, you had the lead character, Jessica Tate, who was Catherine Helmand, who had an affair with a younger man, and lead characters in situation comedies did not have sex with anybody, not even their husbands.
Taboo, right.
Mary Tyler Moore and Dick Van Dyke had separate beds.
Yeah.
And if they were in the bedroom, his foot had to be on the ground.
Right.
That's true. It's the Hays Commission.
Yeah.
We had a young woman, Diana Canova, who had a love affair with a priest who was Sal Viscuso. And they had a scene where she was, you know, seducing him in confessional. And then there was me, the gay guy. This was a network taboo, and we fought so hard to make him just a guy who happened to be gay. He should not be important. Now, this is a long time ago.
Yeah, this is not Modern Family days.
No, and to the callers, you know, this was, you know, sort of groundbreaking stuff that we really had to tread lightly on. There's sections in the book that deal with how hard it was for me and the fellow who played my partner, his name was Bob Segrin, who was an Olympic gold medal winning pole vaulter in real life.
Yeah.
And he's playing this part. And I don't think I understood, I just love the writing of it, what the reaction would be and how difficult it would be to soldier the burden of being
just playing the character.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then as time evolved, Jody had sort of conflicts in his sexuality. Who am I really? And he ends up fathering a child. And we had a court battle for custody of this beautiful little girl. And what was really interesting, ABC did this poll, who do you want to get the baby? And 3-1, they said Jody. And that to me was a testament of how far we had come in developing this character who, you know, back in those years –
this was way outside the regular lines.
Way outside, and I'm very proud of whatever we did in our pioneering efforts. I have to say, with Susan Harris writing this great character.
So
I'm very proud of that, and people still love the show. You know, there's a box set of the 94 episodes that that you can get.
We went
off the air because we didn't have any sponsors. We went off because nobody wanted to sponsor us.
Because of this element, the gay
and because
thread?
Of all, not just me, but because of all of the Christian groups that frowned on this show, put a lot of pressure on sponsors, and that's why we were taken off the air.
So these days, when you sit back, when and if you sit back and watch all the shows, I mean, just on broadcast TV, never mind cable and all the rest, where gay characters are so front and center, what are you thinking?
I think, you know, look how far we've come. And you know, with now all these laws and equal rights and that, isn't that great? But you know, there was a lot of pressure back then, and I sit there with a sense of satisfaction that we may have started something, you know, on television that is now people don't think twice about it.
All the way back in soap, Bob in Windham, Connecticut. Bob, you're on the air with Billy Crystal.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Billy.
Hi.
You know, I would like to share and ask Billy if he remembers a famous, it's my most favorite Billy Crystal moment on the Johnny Carson show many years ago, obviously. And Johnny announced that Billy Crystal was going to be a guest, and he was going to deny him the ability to say, "You look marvelous," which was, you know, Billy's trademark. And Johnny's doing everything once Billy came out on the stage to monopolize the time. Every time Billy would start to speak, Johnny would interrupt and, you know, disrupt Billy's train of thought. And he had announced this, of course, to the audience beforehand, but Billy didn't know. And Billy got, "You look marvelous," in like within 45 seconds. Johnny Carson puts his hands on his head and leans on his desk, and the audience roars. I'm just curious, Billy, do you remember that?
No. I remember coming on the show, of course. I mean, Johnny to me was the king. I did not know of his announcement to do that, honestly. But I do remember, of course, every appearance I made with him. He was really an incredible, incredible superstar and looked up to by all the comedians. And when I did say "You look marvelous" to him, it was really thrilling, because that's where the character first sort of got its birth, was watching the late Fernando Lamas on The Tonight Show with Johnny. And he was so charming, and so, Fernando, Johnny of course, but Fernando was so loose and that Latin lover thing working. You know, he had it turned up to 11 all the time. And so that's where it first started. And any time I was on with Johnny, it was a thrill. But to say to Johnny, "You look marvelous," was really thrilling.
Billy Crystal. One more call for you, Billy. Here's Becky in St. Petersburg, Florida. Becky, you're on the air with Billy.
Hi, Tom. Billy, I have to say, your ability to see human behavior and make it funny is unbelievable. And you have made me and my husband laugh so many times. But one of the most favorite things that I've ever seen was 700 Sundays on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And to this day, we'd love to quote your Yiddish, how you learned Yiddish, or what you thought Yiddish was absolutely hysterical.
Well, thank you. You know, I'm so glad you got a chance to see it. And if you want to see it again, we are opening November 5th, 1 week of previews at the Imperial Theater in New York on Broadway. And then we're going to run through Christmas and holidays to January 6th. And it more than likely, Becky, will be the last time that I do the show. And we've done over 400 of them now. It's still the thrill of my life was being on Broadway that year and bringing the stories that Tom and I have spent the last hour actually talking about and in the book.
I mean, 700 Sundays, that's your calculation of your father's time with the family. He's worked 6 days a week. He worked too much, you write in the book. And
I did, yes.
And that's what he had.
But that was sort of necessity. That's what happened then. You know, the music business had changed. People weren't listening to that kind of jazz anymore. The Dixieland stars that you know were in our house all the time and that kind of music had faded away, and the store closed due to discount places like Sam Goody's and all that stuff. So that's the story of the show, is really also my relationship with him and my pursuit of him once he's gone. Actually, and my relationship with my mom and coming to grips with being a teenager alone. And all of the stuff that we've actually talked about tonight is in this show, and it is it was the work of my life. And I'm glad that Becky got to see it. And if you want to see the show, tickets are on sale now, and I'm not here to promote it, while I'm here, I'm not stupid.
we and, got it. It's coming back last time. There you go, folks.
Yeah.
700.
But thank you, Becky.
Yeah, thank you, Becky. And this sound that everybody loved for so many years. First time hosting the Academy Awards 1990. Billy Crystal opening the night. Lots of laughs and jabs and puns on the latest films of the year. And just before walking off the stage to start the, award giving, he had one more thing to get through.
I know what you're thinking as you look at me. Where's my opening production of it? I know you miss it, don't you? Where's that big, terrible number that usually opens the Oscars? Where is that number where they take all the nominees for Best Picture, put them into one medley? Well, you won't be seeing that tonight. You won't see that number that usually... You won't see that number that usually begins... It's a wonderful night for Oscar, Oscar, Oscar. Who will win? The nominees for Best Picture are...
And there we went with Billy Crystal in 1990... Why did your hosting of that make such an impression on people, Bill? They still talk about it all these years later.
Yeah, I think we did it well. You know, we did different things like that.
Yeah. Horse.
I came out on my horse. I made entrances. I came out with a Hannibal Lecter mask and went into the audience with Anthony Hopkins and told them I'm having some of the members of the Academy over for dinner. But we had fun. We did different things. We did these opening movies. You know, the hosts hadn't done that. I tried to break down the barriers of that and make it entertaining. To me, the first 8 minutes or so were my show, and then the Oscars would begin. But also, you know, in that 8 minutes, be totally respectful, but also poke fun at the Academy itself and the songs and the shows and all that stuff. And we had a really good time. And then you hope that something happens during the show, that you can capitalize on. And I was really fortunate in pretty much all the years that I did it to have good shows.
Hey, Billy, here you are. You're 65. This book is plenty funny all the way through. But you're also going right at death here. You're talking about the burial plot and buying it and getting ready and all that and worrying about who will go first. You or your wife Janice of so many years. Are your friends saying, come on, Billy, 65's the new 50, you know, cut it out. Don't be morbid.
It's not morbid at all. It's always written with a sense of humor and an honesty. And it is the things that I deal with. It's not at all a preoccupation with, you know, I'm not sitting there in, you know, in Ingmar Bergman's frame of mind.
No, you're not.
I don't have the hooded, the shroud, the guy with a scythe playing chess.
Well, maybe somewhere for laughs, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's all done with a really great sense of humor, but the last page is, I think painfully honest and you know, it's some of my favorite writing that I've done.
Boy, you had me in tears there thinking about a lifelong love rare in your business.
Yes.
Who goes first and what heaven might be, you imagine. I'll be 18, you write, and Janice Goldfinger will walk by me in a bikini and I will follow her and it will start all over again. I'd really like to think that. So would we. So
yes.
Would we.
And you don't even know Janice.
No, I don't. But you had me. You had me.
I know. Well, it's honest. It's real. You know, and I hope that everyone has, you know, that fortune in life to have someone that you love so much that you think about that.
Yeah, Billy Crystal, we'll have some of what you're having. We thank you so much for being with us this hour. Billy Crystal's new memoir.
This was a real pleasure, Tom.
Still full of them. Thank you, Billy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.